Hello and welcome to the first ever Jazz Podcast. I am your host, Rob Cope, and sitting beside me is my co-host, Dan Farron.
Hello.
Dan, how's it going?
Very well, thanks, Rob. Can you believe it? We've actually started a podcast.
I can believe it because it's happening. So it's episode one. It's day one. We've gone in 6 weeks from the idea of our podcast through to having a load of shows lined up for you and a lot of very interesting guests. The most exciting bit of all, I'm going to play to you all right now. Check out our introduction.
Welcome to the Jazz Podcast. Conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
So, Gareth Lacrane, we owe you a big debt of gratitude because that's one of Gareth's tracks. He's letting us use it for free. And of course, we're going to be using it every single week for the rest of time. So, Gareth, much appreciated. If you want to check all of that track out, it's an absolute killer. It's on his website, garethlacrane.com, along with some very dashing photos of Gareth. So that's something for you all to enjoy.
So, Rob, we've just started this podcast. What are we going to do in this podcast?
We're actually going to have a very nice talk about jazz, about why we love it or what gigs are on or kind of anything that's relevant, I guess, that week. And then every episode's going to be an interview with a different personality on the jazz scene.
Who have we got coming up then?
Coming up in the first couple of episodes, we've got Kit Downs, James Madron, Femi Tomoro, Laura Judd, Lauren Kinsella. We got a lot of really interesting people coming on.
And what do we talk about with them?
We talk mostly about their life and their career and their journey to how they're making the music that they make now. But inevitably, we also talk about films and food and, you know, it's a very conversational podcast. So just whatever's on their mind that day, that's what it'll be. Yeah.
I think you put it well the other day when you said it's pretty much as if we sat down for a conversation to hang out and then someone happened to be recording it.
Totally. This is a fly on the wall podcast. It's a super conversational vibe. Exactly how it would be is if the mic was not there. So it's not so much a formal interview, but just a kind of window into the personality of the lives of the people that are on the show.
Yeah. So how long is each episode going to be?
Each episode's going to be an hour, regardless of how interesting or dull the guest is.
Does that mean we cut you off if you're talking too long, or is it?
Oh, yeah, we cut you off.
So who? Let's talk about the first episode then we've got. Who's up first?
So episode one right now is Stan Saltzman. So we travelled to his place in East Sheen and sat down over coffee and some sugar-free cake and had a very interesting discussion about
I don't remember the cake.
I think I might have made that up. I think I might have hoped there was cake.
Okay, well, yeah, there wasn't. There definitely wasn't cake.
There was no cake. There wasn't cake, but there was a very long discussion about the first half of his career.
Yeah. How far did we get up to in
his
career?
We talked to him for about an hour and a half, and obviously I hope to do his whole career, but we only made it as far as 1967.
Okay, so we've got a bit left to do. We'll have to do a part two, maybe.
Do a part two for Stan. He loves a good chat, so we can do the second half of his career on another show.
Great. So, Stan Saltzman, shall we press play?
Yeah, check it out.
First off, Stan, I'd like to congratulate you on owning your own home. For all of us on the jazz scene, it's a major achievement, so I have to start there.
Two homes, actually.
You do. I've been to your other place in Box Hill, which is where your whole house is.
We're making a transition. So.
Transition. This house is quite bare. There's your record player still in the corner, which I remember your cat used to sit on when we listened to records, and it would sit and watch it spinning round. That used to really tickle you. It's great. I remember it jumping up there once, and you were yelling, "It loves Miles! It loves Miles!" What did your parents do?
We're going back to Islington, around about the Angel Islington. My family, both from there, my mum and dad were both
Right. A short distance from each other. My dad was family lived in City Road, and my mum's family were from White Lion Street, which is just off of Chapel Street Market. They came through. They were young people during the war years. You know, yeah. Second World War. That was yeah. there. And my mum was from a huge family, very large family, about 8 or 9 children with no yeah. father. And it was really pretty tough going, you know. And,
yeah.
My dad was just an office clerk for London Brick Company. I say just, it sounds a bit cruel. He wasn't, you know, it was good. He was the product, like a lot of people from, particularly around that area, from difficult backgrounds, you know, I mean, hard backgrounds. Life wasn't easy. And the idea was to get a good job, inverted commas, safe
yeah.
job, you know, you didn't aspire to very much. He had very basic, you know, sort of education and stuff. And he was bright and clever, but he didn't aspire to anything above there. He left school and he went straight to work, you know, and he went more or less, spent nearly all of his life, apart from the early part of the war years, he was in engineering around London, but after that it was London Brick Company. So he was just an office clerk in Holborn. But he played accordion and piano. That's the important bit. He was an, you know, and that was, the accordion was a massive instrument around London during those years, sort of war years, really popular instrument. And of course, it's mobile, isn't it? You know, my dad used to play in parties and stuff. He'd go on a charabanc, the local pub. They'd all go off to Southend for the day on a charabanc, you know, the old Bullnose coach.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they'd hire someone to come and play tunes or parties or whatever, you know. He couldn't read or anything. Although he'd had some formal training, a really good technique, but no training about idea of harmony or anything. And he could get around on it, you know. He just loved tunes. He loved some people like George Shearing, because at that time George Shearing was known as an accordion player as well as a piano player when he lived here. That was a thing. Like Stan Tracy, my dad was, oh yeah, Stan Tracy accordion. I went, what, did he play the accordion? Yeah, you know, but that's what people don't remember. And he played the piano, and so my parents moved to Essex. They were given a council flat in Harold Hill in Essex, because that was the new hope. It's a bit like Harlow, Harold Hill, Basildon. They built these huge estates. And so I went there, and my dad sort of stopped playing, which is very sad in a way, but it was so far from London. That might have been a million miles away from London. In those days, transport was so bad. He didn't play anymore. But I'd still had this thing for music. And my dad always thought, what you need to do is like sort of what he did. You got a very safe job, left, got to school, got a couple of O levels, left, got a good job, got an instrument, and you earned more money being a semi-professional musician. Yeah. You know, that's what he kind of thought I might do. So I couldn't get to play an instrument at school. I wanted to play a French horn, and they'd all gone, because this is the days when you could get a school instrument, which is all, of course, finished years ago. But yeah, it's gone really. But you know, they just sort of let you have an good instruments. And then a flute, and that had gone, and they'd gone. And then my dad said, "What do you want to play?" I said, "Well, I'd love to play a saxophone, you know, because I've been hearing all this stuff on the radio." So he took me to Charing Cross Road, which there was a Selma shop in those days.
Oh, cool.
Selma shop in Charing Cross Road.
How old would you have been, do you know?
By this age, by the time I come to get an instrument, I would have been about 11, 12.
Right.
I was born in 1948. And we would have left Islington in about 52, 53.
Yeah.
So, and then moved to this estate. And then I went to my dad part exchanged his accordion and got me this lovely old Selma.
Oh, he part exchanged it? Wow.
Yeah, got me this lovely old Selma saxophone, Super Action.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, and then, quite a few years later, I wanted one with the blue S on the top, you know,
yeah,
six. Little did I know. Anyway, so I had a fantastic... I mean, boy, you'd die for that now, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But it was a great instrument. So, of course, now what do you do? I'm on this council estate, middle of nowhere, you know, and nobody liked jazz. And all the other kids just laugh at you, you know. And I had this saxophone, and I mean, when I did start having some lessons and playing, I remember people throw stones at the window and all that, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, all laughing. What's that funny thing you got in that box, you know? Because it was the age of rock and roll, you know, just after Elvis and Cliff Richards and the Beatles and all that later on. Everybody, it was just all three guitar bands. Saxophone was no longer a glamorous instrument for a young person, you know, as opposed to now.
Yeah.
Every other house, somebody's playing a saxophone. So, anyway, so I was very insular. I was in the house, and my dad found me a teacher by looking in a newspaper in Dagenham, a guy called Terry Porter, who I was still in touch with. He's still alive. He's in his 80s now, and late 80s, and he's retired, doesn't play anymore. Great musician. He was like, oh, what you might... They don't exist anymore. He was a really... He loved swing clarinet players. He was a really good clarinet player, like Benny Goodman and all that, and he loved people that sort of played that. The old booty tenor players, Flip Phillips, Illinois Jacquet, not as they played on the Jazz at the Field things, but how they really played, because that was kind of affected, you know, for those records. That was all the kind of screaming harmonics and stuff. They're actually really good players. They're all from... You know, that big sounding tenor line. And, you know, Sonny Rollins and people like Sonny Stitt. He had some records. You know, first of all, oh, I've got a Sonny Rollins record. He had the lovely one with Dizzy, the one with Sonny and the two Sonnies and Dizzy, mm-hmm. with on the Sunny Side of the Street and all those things, Eternal Triangle. He had, actually had the album, you know. So I met, I got started to go to, have to go to Becontree on the weekend. Becontree's near Dagenham,
yeah.
which took about, hour and a half, 2 hours to get there. It was like two buses and a train and something else and a half an hour walk. And I just used to go with my tenor in this big case set off, you know, sort of 7 and 6, whatever it was for my lesson. But I never learned anything about jazz like, you know, 2-5-1 and it didn't know anything about any of that. Didn't clue. I had one book, I think, Helmer Cusack or McCusick. That's a West Coast alto player, transcribed solos, but there's not really any information.
Yeah.
Occasionally used to play around with this thing. So my jazz education was just sitting at home on my own, because nobody played at school. I was just sit with a record player. Just used to sit and put this Danzette record, mono record player, and loads of records. My dad used to buy records and stuff. And I'd sit and play along with it with no idea what I was doing or what anything was. You know, I had no idea about... I used to play along with the Hampton Hawes Trio record. It was lovely. Really good record. And I had one Zoot Sims album. I had loads of 78s I bought from Doble's. Used to love it, going to Doble's record shop in Charing Cross Road. Saturdays, my dad would take me there. And you'd come through the second-hand department in the basement. And it always... I still have it now. There's this thing about the smell of the records. Mm-hmm. Dusty old Shellac records. Fantastic. It's like, oh.
So would you learn these solos as you're playing along? Or you just noodling away?
Just noodling along with it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, transcription, what's that? I said, well, I'd have to look it up in a dictionary. I didn't know... Nobody did, but... No, the idea that people transcribe solos. I mean, nobody told me anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a great upbringing as a child. It was lovely. Yeah. I didn't suffer in any way. But, I mean, in terms of music...
Yeah.
And I didn't do music at school. I didn't get on with a music teacher at that school in Essex.
Yeah.
Not until we moved. We were, when I was about 13, 14, we moved to Southfields near Wimbledon. My parents got up, well, in those days, you could get an exchange within the old GLC, which is up where the big wheel is now in London. You could go there and people used to exchange their flats and stuff, you know, like, I want to go to Harlow.
Do a straight swap.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. Yeah, and it was all arranged through there, you know, and you put cards in a box and people would come and look through and, oh, that look, you know. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's how they come to be back in Wimbledon. So, by now, I'd got back to Wimbledon, so now at least I'm around town. I was with my mum and dad was still. I was at school. I had to transfer school to. I went to Sir Walter St. John's in Battersea, but I wasn't allowed to take music at school. I did meet a couple of people. There was a really good piano player that played sort of ragtime kind of piano player, and maybe a bit later on, more like Teddy Wilson. And then my dad saw the in the paper about an advert in the formation of a jazz big band called the London Jazz Orchestra. London Youth Jazz Orchestra, which within a few months, I think, turned into the National Youth Jazz Orchestra. But it was Bill Ashton that started. And it wasn't just him. There was another guy. And I'm ashamed to say, I can't remember his name. He was a lovely guy. I can see him now. With a big, bushy beard, tall man, lovely, lovely person. And the two of them ran this band. So I saw this advert. It had been formed the first week, and they did an advert for it, a write-up in the paper. And my dad called up the number and, send him along. You know, so I went the second week, you know. And that's how I joined that band. People like Jeff Castle played piano in there. Frank Ricotti played alto saxophone, who's now the percussion player, you know. Quite a few, there was a few other people came through. Chris Lawrence was in the band a bit after me. I mean, it was a pretty terrible band. It's not like the National Youth Jazz Orchestra. I mean, none of us could read, couldn't play.
Yeah.
And brass playing was pretty bad as in terms of brass. You know, when you think of it now, they're just like professional bands, aren't they? I mean, it was nothing like that. But we used to have a ball, we used to go to the Marquee on Sunday mornings. So I sometimes do the Saturday, I was at school, I'd get up and then do Saturday night at the Flamingo or something. You do the all-nighter. The all-nighter was 1 till 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
He's finished at 6 in the morning.
Oh, that's brutal. I can't do
start
that.
At 1. And then there was the evening session before. But I loved it. I was a kid. I'm in the West End. There's all this sort of glamorous kind of seedy nightlife. You know, when you're 16, 17, it's the place you want to be, isn't it? You know. So, and all this music going on. It's great, you know. But then I just sort of get up and somehow I get myself to the Marquee for Sunday afternoon to do the Nigel band. And we got a few gigs and that, and a few people came along. I think Tubby came once in front of the band, a few other people. It was, those days were difficult because there's no easy way of saying it, really. But I mean, I've often thought about this, but I never got any lessons from anybody because I didn't know how to approach any of them. I was scared of them. My dad would take me to Ronnie's, the first Ronnie's. I remember going third when I was 13 or 14, and they were fearsome. You know, Ronnie's immaculate in the suit, kind of serious and grim. They weren't approachable people. It's not like you go into the Academy or the Guildhall or, you know, Trent Park, and everybody's kind of friendly, and it wasn't like that. They were a bit kind of, it was a bit like you, they were up there and you were down here. That may not be the case, but it's how I perceived it. Yeah. I was from a background of not, you know, not much idea about how to go out and get things in the world. I didn't know. Nobody had ever told me. The idea was just get out of school, get your O-levels, get a job. And then there was these other people, you know. And then yeah. I'd heard this, people like Tubby Hayes, Ronnie Scott were fearsome. Ronnie Scott, fantastic tenor player. People forget that. They think he was a club owner and a comedian. Actually, he was everybody's favourite tenor player sometimes, more than Ronnie. He was a great, great player. But he didn't have quite the confidence. I mean, Tubby was incredible. Quite a remarkable musician, as you probably have seen. That, you know, whatever he touched, he was just like Alan Branscombe, who died these days, but another one around at that time. Fabulous. Yeah. Peter King, who's still around. You know, he played a lot of tenor in those days.
Oh, cool.
Bobby Wellings, who's just passed away. And, of course, Bobby was, you know, even if you did see him, you know, with all the problems, well, everybody, you know, with all the drug problems and stuff, Tubby and all of them, you were a bit feared. They were either drinking or using every drug. You know, they weren't sort of people that you could approach.
I know what you mean. Now, if you go into the, like, Royal Academy Cafe, everyone's having a coffee and a chat.
Exactly. Do you know what I mean? The idea of, like, getting someone who's a junkie and a drinker and saying, oh, could I have a lesson at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning? You know, I mean, forget it. It's not going to happen, is it? You know, so. But that may not have been the case. As always, there are people you could have got to, but I didn't find my way to them and I wasn't pointed. So I missed out on an awful lot. But that's not necessarily, it's just partly the scene at that time and partly me not being able to, knowing how to access anything. So that was my kind of early days through there. You know, I was going up and I was enjoying it. It was lovely, you know. But I didn't know what I was doing. I was like reading chords of a big batch. I didn't understand anything about harmony at all. I really struggled with it all. I didn't learn till later on by being with people, like being with John Taylor or something. The first time I met John, you know, I thought, well, John, what's that? What are you doing? What's this? And you're like, oh, yeah, well, it's that, you know. Or Gordon Beck or somebody who you were working with, asking people what they were doing. And, you know, a bit of research, and you kind of put the picture together as you best you could yourself.
Do you remember when you met John Taylor?
Yeah, oh, I do, yeah. I was in a party in Wandsworth One Way System. The bass player around at that time, I would have been about 19 or something. Yeah, maybe 19, 20. I was playing with Graham Collier at that time. And Jill was, her name was Jill Lyons at that time. She was married to a baritone player, oboe, called bassoon player, I think it was Graham Lyons, who was in Collier's, Graham's band. I didn't know him actually, but and I think she'd separated from him. But they had a house just off of Wandsworth One Way System, lovely house, the top end with a big basement. She used to have parties there, you know. She's a bass player, Jill. So she used to run these. She's a very sociable person, lovely, lovely woman, and she ran these big parties. And I went to this party, and as like all parties, the idea was everybody had a blow, you know, and that John would happen to be there. I just had a play with him, and. We all sort of got on like immediately. We were interested in the same kind of things we've been listening to. And, well, you know, that kind of, oh, you like that? Oh, wow, you know, and there's a bit of chemistry, I suppose.
Yeah.
And it wasn't long after. He was forming a sextet, which I went along to. I remember because at that time he lived in Knollys Road in Streatham. Him and Norma and John were together at that time. And he was forming this sextet, which was Tony Levin, who I didn't really know Tony. I met Tony. Chris Lawrence, obviously, I knew. Me, Ken Wheeler and Chris Pine.
Right.
So that's where I kind of, you know, kind of met.
Is that him. How you met Kenny as well then?
No, I'd met Kenny through Graham's. Actually, I met Kenny when I was playing in this Pally band.
Right.
In Amulet, because I did a pop session in what we call Tin Pan Alley, which was just off of Shaftesbury Avenue.
Yeah.
It's what we called Eggbox Studios, because they were studios with literally egg boxes on the wall. That was the soundproof and cheap places. People made, you know, knocked out records. And I did something to do with this Pally band. I had to go along and play with a couple of horns on a pop thing. I can't. And then there was me and a trumpet player, and the door opened to the studio, and in walks Ken Wheeler. And it was like, hello. And Ken was like quiet as a dormouse, particularly in those days. I mean, much more than he was later on. And I was shy beyond belief. I never spoke to anybody about anything. I was really an original wallflower. I was very shy, insecure. I wasn't a bit different than the horrible, surly bloke I am now. But I didn't speak, you know.
Yeah.
So we both sat next to each other. Oh, hello, hello. You know, we both played this thing. And went, oh, God, nice to see you. And that was it.
Yeah.
It was Ken. So that's when I first met him.
Right.
We were doing this silly session, you know. And then I met him in Graham Collier's band. Graham had a 12-piece band over and above his sextet. And we got this thing. Carl Jenkins was the piano player. He's now Addy Amos. That's his guy. He played piano, oboe, and baritone saxophone. Great musician, Carl. Fantastic player. And he wrote great pieces as well, jazz pieces. Carl's in John Marshall, John Mumford, trombone player, Henry Lowther, Harry Beckett. Anyway, in the 12-piece, Ken Wheeler suddenly came in on trumpet, and while he was playing the secondly, other people brought a piece into play, because I didn't get on with Graham's music. I mean, we'll get into that now, but I mean, he did a lot for me in a way that I was in a band that worked, and you were working every, if not every week, certainly, you know, half a dozen, 10, 12 times a month. It was like having a job in the band, and I was playing with John Marshall and Carl. I was learning from Carl. Harmony and stuff, and
yeah,
you know, so it did me a lot of good. But I didn't like the music he wrote. But this 12-piece, but all of a sudden, there's Ken Wheeler, and he put this. It was called 25 Blue. This piece, I remember it now. We played this people. Actually, it got retitled. It's on Windmill Tilter, but it's one of the other pieces because all the tunes were retitled for that record
right.
to make the suite. You know, and I immediately played this and went, oh. That's it, you know. This is, you know, when you found this is the music.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, lo and behold, you know, there it was. It's fantastic, you know.
What's the piece called?
Well, I knew it was 25 Blue.
Right.
But I can't remember, I can't remember which one it is. It's on, but it got retitled on Windmill Tilter.
Right.
I'm trying to remember which piece it is. I think, sure, I could do that now. I mean, you pick any of them anyway, they're all brilliant.
Yeah.
You know? But it's the whole, that sound and the, you know, the whole thing about it, you know.
Yeah.
And the heart, and of course, it wasn't from bebop. And that's the thing, was it? It's like,
yeah.
Before that, struggling to try and play, there's no way I was going to play standards like Ronnie Scott or Tubby Hayes or Bobby Windsor anyway. I'm not going to get anywhere near it. But I'd met John Taylor. I'm playing with these people. It's all playing original music. And then you hear Ken Wheeler's music, which is original music, but with something about it that's had the same quality, but... You know, and very soon, because I was in that little pool, you start working with people, you get asked to do something, and I got good at interpreting that kind of music. So I was very good at being able to play non-functional harmony and stuff. You know, I work hard at the... You don't need the same... It wasn't the same thing as trying to find your way, pick your way through a diatonic chord sequence. It's different. Well, in actual fact, it isn't different in the end. It actually, what I realised over the last years, it all comes to the same thing. But if you see what I mean, you know, like working your way through individual eight bars on this chord, four on that one, changed it to something that's unrelated, wasn't quite the same as having to pick your way through.
Yeah.
So I became very... I was playing in John Taylor's band. I was really good at dealing with all the kind of, you know, people were breaking all the time up and doing all different stuff, finding my way through it. And I found my little niche, you know. But I mean, the run-up to that as well, around that time, is I'd left school. I had a day job just before that. I worked in an insurance company, Sun Life Assurance, in Cheapside. So I had a suit and everything and an umbrella, you know, got sat the tube train, go from Southwark, go to work in this office, which with loads of lovely people, you know, but I hated it, you know, the idea of sitting there with a Munro adding up machine, doing figures for insurance. I mean, it was not what I wanted to be doing, you know. And... I remember a couple of things happened. One is I did they took five people out of Nigel to do a TV show. It was called 5 o'clock Club, run by a woman called Muriel Young, was the presenter. Kids programme, 5 o'clock on TV. And it was me and Frank playing alto. I'm playing tenor. Chris Lawrence on bass. Bobby Worth playing drums. He's Bobby's around, sort of really good modern mainstream drummer. Does loads of work, particularly on the mainstream circuit. You know, Bobby, great. He was the same age as us. And a guy called Pete Solly, who nobody will know now, but he played piano and organ at that time. But he played piano on this thing. So we had a quintet. We played, it was a Clifford Brown thing. Jordu. Tune called Jordu we played on this kids program. And right after that, Bill Ashton from the National Youth Jazz Orchestra used to get a few calls looking for musicians, a bit like you probably get in the academy, you know, people need musicians thing. They were looking for musicians, someone short notice to go on the boats for a year. So I went on, cut a long story short, I went on the Queen Mary for a year. I left my day job, much to the horror of my parents and the people in there. I said, oh, you don't want to leave? The guy in the sort of personnel department, he said, yeah, it's a good job, you'll be a job for life with a pension and everything. And, you know, as a musician, lives up the road, it's a terrible life and all that. And I thought, I'm off, you know. So I went on the Mary. So I just went as a ship's musician. In fact, you had to sign on as crew. I get a crew card. You know, you have to go, you can under ship's law and everything. Get a seaman's card, I had a seaman's card. And I did it up till they sold it, the last trip out of New York. But 1967, so I had the most fantastic year on the boats. I shared with a drummer called Terry Rodd, Terry still plays great drums. He's from Cornwall. His brother is Vivian Rodd. He ran the Truro College for quite some time. I think that's finished now. Really good piano player, great piano player. Anyway, I shared a cabin with Terry. There's a good bass player from Scotland called Lindsay Cooper and a good guitar player on the boat called Kenny Vick, who is also an alcoholic. A true one. You used to see spiders crawling up the wall and all this stuff. But he was a great guitar player. Because these are old school guys, you know. A lot of them gravitated to the boats. The two types of people on the boats were either old school divorced drinkers. It was an easy life. You could drink all day and night, get your clothes washed and food given to you. And young people like me wanted to go to New York. You had this funny kind of balance of people. You know, it's a weird scene. But it was great. You know, I was, 18, 19. Here I'm heading off to New York. It's fantastic. There's no other way of getting there. How could I afford to go to New York? No cheap flights. No such thing. You know, the only way you're going to get there is go on a boat, which is what all the old, you know, you see those TV people. Ronnie Scott went, Dankworth went, Bill Lesage. People went, they went on the boats. So I caught that. So the music I had in New York was fantastic. You know, I mean, I saw Miles' band at the Village Gates out on the stage, right in front of them, where I am to this wall. I'm sat there listening to Herbie.
How long would you stay in the city for?
Like 2 days, 48 hours, turned around. I never used to go to bed, just got off the show. called up a number called the Jazz Line, and we went out, and that was it, you know, because clubs ran till really late. You could make three clubs in the night. I used to go to get off the Mary and first port, Mary docked on 52nd Street.
Right.
So you used to get off the boat, walk up 52nd Street. Birdland had closed up that year. It was all boarded over, you know.
Yeah.
But the first thing you come to was the Market Diner, which was a 24-hour sort of eggs and bacon and stuff, which I'd never seen anything like that in England. Never heard of a place, you know, just go in there, get you something to eat and drink. Right. We'd all, where are we going to go, you know? So we dial up a phone number called the Jazz Line. Which you could get out of the Village Voice, which is a paper you could buy, and that had all the listings paper, or this number, you dial this number up, and then you got a bit of paper and a pen, and you went down, okay, the Blue Note tonight, there's whatever, you know, so-and-so's quartet, something like that, cover charges, so blah, 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 somebody somewhere else, you used to write it all down as fast as you could, and then work out what you wanted to do. And we used to just walk a bit further up the road and go to the Hickory House, which was a steakhouse, with a big round stage in the middle. You sat round this horseshoe bar. It was Billy Taylor with Grady Tate on drums and Bob Cranshaw or something like that on bass. Go and sit and listen to this trio, work out where to go, and then we'd all head off, you know.
Yeah.
I went a lot to the Vanguard, so a lot of Mel Lewis, Thad Jones' band quite a few times. The original band, which was fantastic, you know, including seeing the Depps in the band, Herbie Hancock, Depping, which is quite something, with his glasses on, you know, in a big book of paper in front of him now. And Bill Evans' trio, obviously, to see them there, Gary Burton's band with Roy Haynes. Charlie Mingus' quartet, saw them with Charles McPherson, Danny Richmond, in a tiny little place, Pookie's Pub. Joe Henderson with Kenny Barron and Lewis Hayes, all these sorts of bands in the club, tiny little clubs, some of these places, nobody in them. I went to quite a few with Terry, I'll tell you, we were the only two, and I mean the
wow,
only two,
that's
and they'd
weird.
Be, the guys would be playing, they'd be laughing, yeah. and nudging each other.
Yeah,
just like looking at us like, because we're just young kids, we're obviously just really young kids, you know.
Yeah.
And rock and roll was in, and English rock and roll had wiped the jazz scene clean in New York, kind of trashed it, you know. That's why a lot of, you know, they all eventually started more and more coming to Europe, because
yeah.
it was wrecked there.
Wow.
I mean, I didn't understand any of this, I was too young, yeah. I didn't know anything about any of this stuff, you know. So we'd be in this club, and they'd come down to in the break and talk to you, you know, and say, hey, you guys, where are you from? I said, well, we're on a boat, we're jazz fans. Yeah? So, yeah, we can't hear you play. You know, it's sort of, it's fantastic.
Wow, wow.
And very close proximity, and they were really nice, really lovely people. I don't remember ever having a bad time or somebody giving you a hard time. You know, they were really lovely and friendly. I remember a cab driver taking us to one club. We wanted to go to the Blue Note, I think it was. Was it a half note? It was a half note. Saw Elvin Jones with the Elvin had a band with Frank Foster tenor player. Little quarter after, because this was the year Coltrane died and he wasn't playing. I think they were, you know, that Elvin probably had to put together bands, keep working. You know? And the cab driver took us down. It was a black cab driver, and he said, "Well, you want to go there?" He said, "Yeah, you want to go there?" I said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "Well, you're a jazz fan, you want to go?" He said, "Oh, great!" And he started talking about jazz and saying, "What are you doing?" He said, "We working on the Queen Mary." And Americans loved the Mary; they remember it from the war because it was a troop ship.
Mm-hmm.
Very fond memories of that boat. So it was a kind of a little way of making friends very quickly, you know. And he took us and he said, "Hey, yeah." And I thought he'd said that my brother, Pete LaRocca, he's a drummer, because I didn't know who Pete LaRocca was. But I realised much later on, I think it must have been him, because he drove a cab, if you read up about Pete LaRocca, who was the original guy that played, he should have been on, you know, the famous Rollins record with Elvin's on it, the Village Vanguard, where I think Pete plays on one track or something, but Elvin sat in, but a lot of the tracks issued are actually with Elvin on. But it was actually Pete's gig, Pete LaRocca. But he was lovely, you know, and he didn't charge us. Oh, no fee, you know, just get out of the cab, just like really nice people, and we wandered around there. I went down to the black parts of New York, which was, people were like, "You haven't been there, have you?" Said, "Yeah," but I didn't understand anything about racism, or I just wanted to go and hear music. I mean, I didn't understand what any of it was. I honestly swear to you, I was so naive, I didn't know anything about any of that. But it was the year of the race riots, obviously, it was really heavy. You know, they were out in the streets, it was a lot of bad violence. I never encountered anything, you know.
Yeah.
And I had a ball there, but I had a lot of music, you know. I came back, and then the boat was sold, and I'd finished at the end of 67. And I went to music college after that.
You went to the Royal College?
I went to the Academy.
You went to Academy?
I went after, because I met a guy on the boat who'd come out of the Academy, Chris right. Gradwell, who was a straight clarinet player, who played yeah. saxophone. And I helped him to try and learn how to play tunes and stuff on the boats to do the dance band gig, because that's yeah. what we did. Called tunes, bus tunes, you know. And a bit of cabaret, if you can call it. It was really naff. I mean, terrible bands, you know. And he taught me a bit how to read and stuff, and helped me to get. Said you should go to a college. I said, "I can't. I've never done any music school." And he said, "Oh, come on!" And I got my old music teacher, and I applied at the Guildhall first and didn't get in because I wanted to do flute, and I wasn't good enough. Which I wasn't a good enough flute player, you know.
Yeah.
Then I switched. I went to the Academy as first study saxophone and flute. I did this right. the first year there, which Dankworth was made the saxophone teacher.
Oh, great.
So I got in and I swapped over to flute the second year so I could yeah. get my Derek Honor.
Why did you want to go as flute?
To learn the double.
To begin with, right.
You know, I thought it was the thing to do. Because that was the other thing when I was young. It was like, because you're a doubler, Rob, you know, I mean, not so many people necessarily double now, but that yeah. time it was like, you can't be a musician if you don't double. It was just unheard of, as far as I, you know, the word was, you have to play loads of, everybody did, flute, clarinet, and as you know, the studio players later on, it was flute, piccolo, alto, flute, clarinet, bass, clarinet, tenor, alto, guys had big armfuls of instruments, even up to the people like Bob Efford, who was a great tenor player of Ted Heath's band, who went to live in the west coast of States in LA.
Yeah.
He's on those Bill Holman records, if you've heard of those things over the last few years, he's often played baritone on. Great tenor, but he played oboe as well, but he started to do the double reed instruments. So there was a big thing about learning to double instruments, so that was my idea, you know. I went to the Academy and I managed to swap around, but I was getting lessons with John Dankworth, but I'd also started just then to work in his big band, the big band at Ronnie's. So it was kind of funny, you know, and he was interested. He was more interested in the kind of music, the new music that was coming up, which is not for me, but the stuff I was playing with people like John Taylor and Ken Wheeler and John and stuff, for these long, these kind of, you know, figured bass things and long away from different music, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a lot of change. I mean, one funny thing, just to tell you, just to finish about the boats, there was a guy called, he's still around, he's a good piano player called Pete Lima, who I met on the boats as we were coming back on one of the trips from New York. And he came on the boat and said, Pete, what are you doing? He said, I'm coming back to England. I've been living in New York for 9 months or a year. Somehow or other he got a work permit or visa, or maybe it was illegal. I think his family had something to do with the fur trade. You know, there's a lot of fur trade business still going on between New York and London.
Yeah.
Fur shops, Oxford Street, you know, family. Anyway, whatever. Pete had gone out there and he came back. And so he said, oh, when we finished all the rubbish, the few of us on the boat, those that could play, we go and have a play in the so-and-so bar or whatever. So we go, come and play. Yeah, you know, so Pete came and played. And Pete went, he said, have you ever heard this? And he went, oh no, I'm not going to do it. There's a piano there. He went, dun, 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 do, 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 dun, 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 you know, Maiden Voyage, up a minor third, dun, dun. And we all went, what's that? it's the new music. It's what's coming out of New York, you know. And it's like the first time we'd heard people do something like that. So that was quite a big thing. Funny enough, I always remember Pete saying that. And then, you know, the next minute you go out and you bought, every time I was in New York, I bought armfuls of records.
Yeah.
So I got Maiden Voyage, you know. Wow, look at that. It's fantastic, you know. It's a different music. Anyway, I brought all that back to England. I came back, ended up working with Graham, John Taylor. The English scene, the music around that time was the most sort of, I don't know, popular. The stuff that was always on the front of the magazines, such as they were, jazz magazines or the, new, you know, papers. Melody Maker might have still been around. I did some jazz stuff in there. Eventually it went, you know, Melody Maker became a pop paper and disappeared. But it was Mike Westbrook's band, because it was John Sermon, and then Sermon really, but it was Westy that was the band lead, so it was Sermon was sort of like the new... But in that year I'd been away, Tubby'd been sick, and Neil, he had a heart operation and stopped playing, and the whole scene, like, things changed. All of a sudden... all of a sudden we've got John Sermon and Mike Osborne and all the people who are playing kind of free jazz or much more full on, you know, all the kind of stuff. Everybody's drummers smashing kits to pieces and everybody's flat out, you know, it was different. And that was quite a big change, you know. I think Tony Levin told me that Tubby found that very difficult, you know, when all of a sudden he came back, everything had changed. He wasn't like on the front of the papers every week, and the music had changed. And you'll know he tried to play a few free things, didn't he, on a couple of records, and Mexican Green. They don't sound convincing. It's not really his music. I mean, it was just like going through what you do. You go, you know, but it wasn't right. And then there were people like John Stevens and Evan Parker and Derek Butler. You know, a little bit of that scene had started up, which was really revolutionary, you know. And the odd bits of that was on the radio. Radio used to cause mayhem, you know. I actually heard a BBC news reader at midnight. I swear this is true on my children's life. This is true. I think the programmes used to be on Sunday night, maybe. And there was 2 half-hour slots of bands. The second, from 11 till midnight, and the Arbos 11 slot, they'd put over the latest one. It was like a sextet, you know, with Evan and Derek Bailey and somebody else. And it was all... you know, it was all that kind of, you know, really out, you know, just completely. And it come out, so the program finishes, the music sort of goes out, and then it was bong, and you hear the Big Ben chime, and the news really came on, and you went, my word. Well, it's time for the news after that, you know. Sort of, they actually made a comment about it. I swear to you, as I sit in this chair, I was gobsmacked. It's funny, you know. But it was so shocking to hear this. And you can imagine outrage, people writing things in paper, you know, like the disgraceful noise, you know, terrible noise. It's nothing to do, you know. Of course, now it's just, oh, well, Evan's doing a gig, you know. I mean, it's quite different and radical, and it's not, but, oh, it's improvised music, you know. It's like it's got a name and you put it there and it sort of fits. But because at that time, that was really outrageous.
Mm-hmm. What were you getting paid to do the boats? And how many sets?
Oh, the boats?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't remember what it was. Something like 12 quid a week or something, or 10 quid a week or something like that. And the overtime rate was like, you know, 10 bob an hour. This is before, I think we were still in old money, you know, this is before decimal. Mm. So we used to play late nights. It was great, you know, if we get it to go past. It used to be tricks. I used to play in the sort of dance lands where the afternoon was terrible. You have to play Teddy Bear's Picnic for the kids for their jellies and blancmanges and all that, and throw food around, you know, it's horrible. You know. Played all that sort of rubbish. I played. And play on the deck. Used to play the American marches. Play the ship out of New York on the deck.
Wow.
I played marches. I played all that stuff. You know, Sousa. Is it Sousa? American military kind of music.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a whole load of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like Jimmy Lally's printed arrangements. Used to play these kids' parties. Then we'd do, in the evening, play for dancing and the purses. But after that, we used to play in a little bar on the top of the ship. Right at the top, break right down to a little trio or quartet. And people used to come in a late night bar and drink. And if you could, used to spot the passengers, work out what they like to tune, they'd like to hear. Well, the one at the time was What Now My Love, Dr. Zhivago. She could play anything as a waltz or a sort of bossa nova. Mm. And she'd just play all night long. But people used to love this tune. They'd come walking, you see them walking past the bar, you start playing the tune, they go, and they could hear it. They come, oh, and they come in the bar. Buy you a bowl, buy us all a drink. Oh, thank you very much, you know. And keep us on over time. Great. But that little bar used to have little plays, you know. And that was a good scene. But on there, also, there's one lovely one where people, American artists, jazz players, used to come to England to do Ronnie's because it was a cheap way of coming. So the year I was Yusef Lateef. And he was a lovely guy, and he met him, and he said, oh, can we play anywhere? Because he wanted to keep his chops going, because he's doing something, doing Ronnie Scott. Said, well, we go down in the laundry room, which is what we used to do. We used to pay 2 bob to some guy in the laundry. And it was all corruption. The whole of the Queen Mary was run on total corruption, which you had to learn about, you know. You drop somebody, it's half a crown or so-and-so, and there was an all-day breakfast, or a big chicken would arrive in your room, all covered nicely in the dome. You know, everything was corrupt. It was unbelievable. I had to learn. It was a fast learning curve about the art of corruption, you know. Yeah. So we said, well, we go down in the laundry rooms. He said, yeah. So we went there. Me and Murray Lucas was a drummer who's dead now. Used to play around London. He came on the boats only a few trips. He got sent off. He got caught smoking some pot. You know, we nowadays don't just laugh at it. It was a prisonable offence in those days. But Murray was a good player, and Lindsay Cooper was a good bass player. Me or Terry Rodd would come down as a drummer, a friend of mine. He was a really good player. Somebody else, and then Yusef came down. So we just played down, you know, amongst all the sort of sheets and rubbish. We stood there playing away, and then we got him to come and play for the crew, you know, which was unbelievable. All these big stokers, you know, big guys in the crew. And I said, come play for the crew on Sunday mornings. We always play for the crew. So, okay, this week, ladies and gentlemen, well, not the moment, the ladies are all guys, you know, the big, big guys with broken noses and kind of like, Yusef Lateef, you know. Oh, it's a fantastic, you know, experience. The year before, it was Clark Terry been on. He came on and made big friends with a trumpet player called Barry Roberts. Really good player. Mm-hmm. Lovely. And Clark Terry's a lovely man. I didn't meet him. I did a record that I had to be on in Olympic in Manchester, and Clark After Dark, with the big band and strings. He's a real gentleman. He's a lovely, lovely man. And partly a wonderful player, you know. And he befriended Barry, this English champion player, and took him out in New York. It was lovely. He took him down to Baze's Club. And he had to lay down in the back of the taxi when he went through the black area, you know, to be seen sitting up on. Took him in the club, and it all went quiet. And he looked, and they saw he was with Clark, and it was like, it's okay, you know, it's like a white guy in the black club. It's like, okay, come in, he was a big friend. Funny stuff. And so you met a few of these musicians would come over on the boats as well, you know, you met few of them. Yusef was lovely.
So what year are we up to now?
That's around about 67. I was on the boat. The year I was on the Mary was 67.
67.
Yeah, and I came off with 68. Ronnie's, the old place was still going, and it closed then, and that's when it moved to Frith Street. But they kept the old place going. So around 65, 66.
Right.
I really am honestly bad with dates, so I'll tell you that now. But around that period is when the old place was going, then it swapped. They got the new one up, but they kept the old one open for a while. And that was the old place John Jack used to book the bands in. And that's where it really... So people like Mike Westbrook's band would be playing one or two nights a week there. You know, it gave them a home. Mm. Chris McGregor, all the South Africans would play there regularly. Oh, a lovely Jamaican piano player. Great, lovely man. You know, there's all these sort of regular...
Yeah.
Oh, Russ Henderson.
Right.
Russ Henderson, well, that's done. It. Thank so it also had like a slightly Jamaican band. I think Sermon used to play with Russ Henderson. So they used to, there was this guy's learning sort of a bit of a Jamaican influence. If you like, it's almost the beginnings of like little bits of people doing worldly music, kind of, you know, the African thing coming in or the.
Yeah.
Because it was, because that's what was in London.
Yeah.
All the Americans that came to Europe around that time, you know, because jazz was dead, it really was, States. They were all pouring into Europe. They couldn't come to England because of the Union. The musicians' union wouldn't let them in. That's why they all went to Scandinavia. That's why they're all in Denmark and Sweden. And
right.
Because, you know, Tootie Heath, drummer, and,
yeah.
Dexter Gordon, Kenny Drew.
Yeah.
Oh, crap.
But the government here was quite keen on the Commonwealths after the war. And, like, so I guess they're like Jamaicans, South Africans.
Oh, they, yeah, well, they could come. Guys, well, they would be English passports, wouldn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, there was that free flow, but not Americans.
No.
You couldn't come here. And then the only reason that eventually they got those exchanges going was because of it was because of rock and roll. Actually, it did us the biggest favour ever, the English rock and roll craze, because all the American business wanted English rock. They wanted the Beatles and the Rolling yeah. Stones and this one and, you know, whoever, all these kind of Liverpool rock bands, hundreds of them there were, you know. And so they did a one-for-one exchange basis,
right.
One-for-one person exchange. So take a big pile of these bands over, and all of a sudden, it was Harold Davidson used to bring in, he'd suddenly bring in whatever, you know, big that's bands great. As well, Ellington's band, yeah. Or Basie's band. I didn't Ronnie, that's how, but Harold Davidson had to do, started, got involved, partly ran Ronnie Scott's, he got taken over. Harold Davidson ran that club, you know, got beyond Ronnie eventually.
Yeah.
And Ronnie, that's how they started to do this one for one exchange, and that's, I think the first person that came was Dexter.
Oh, wow.
And it was Zoot Sims, Al Cohn, and Staggers. And I saw all of them. I was 13. My dad took me. I saw
yeah.
Dexter. I remember going Saturday afternoon in my short trousers. I was 13 years old. I just got a saxophone. And I'd loved this record I had at Dexter. My old teacher had played me. And they did an afternoon, Saturday afternoon session. And I went to the club, you know, and it was hot in the summer. Came out, and after it finished at 6 or 7, they were going to do an evening show.
Yeah.
Because it was a tiny little club. You know, it was yeah. a taxi driver's cafe is what it was. Before I came out into the street, and there's Dexter sat on the steps outside. If you go down Chinatown, you see, you know, the steps above the basements there. Mm-hmm. He was sat on the steps. My dad took me up, you know, oh, this is my son, he's, you know, Stan, he's learning to play the saxophone, and he's just sort of big, shook hands and this big, you know, I was like, I thought I'd gone to heaven.
Yeah,
this my magical person. You can imagine a big black. I mean, I didn't see that. You know what I mean? Everything about him was just like smart. You know, he looked immaculate clothes and the accent, and he just played fantastic. You know, it's like looking at God. You know, so it's fantastic little experiences. And I saw all those. I saw Getz down there, Stan Getz. You know, imagine a tiny little
yeah.
club that didn't hold more than I don't know 60 people or something. And so where you are, he's playing there, and you're sat virtually there in front of him.
Yeah.
And Zoot and Al, which was absolutely fabulous. Zoot Sims, Al Cohn.
Yeah.
And Tubby's band, I saw a lot. Ronnie's band. All sorts of people came one after another. That was, it was the one for one exchange.
That's mate, just like the council flats, swapping yeah. musicians. I'll have him, and then you can have these guys.
So that was the sort of world I came into.
Yeah. Know?
And then I went, so I was a mature student at the academy. I went as a late student.
Yeah.
I'd already started working a bit in bands and spent a couple of years at the academy, which I wasted most of it. I didn't work hard at all because I was already working and I had a family. I had a young son on the way,
yeah.
married too young and all that stuff. And
yeah.
sort of dark things you did in that time, you know. Loved them all to death, but, you know, just, I mean, when you look back at your life, I know lots of people. There were different times, you know, this is a whole different generational thing after the Second World War, after that thing coming from parents that had lived through that. When I look back at it now, it was a whole different climate, you know, the way yeah. things operated. It's not like it is now.
No.
Of course, the other thing is you could go to college in those days and there were no fees. You just got a grant.
Yeah.
You could afford to waste time.
Okay.
There were loads of work, jobs, so if you wanted to bum around and not do much,
okay.
you could, and you could just pick up a job and earn some money. It's not, you know, there were different yeah. times, very, very different.
Where were you living after you came back from the ships? And
I got off the boats at various places, so obviously I'd started, been used to being away. I'd back to mum and dad's first.
Yeah.
For a little short while, I had a flat around near Euston, around the back of there, with Frank Riccotti, which his parents rented this place, but they let us have it. I met my first wife soon after on a summer school in the old Barry Summer School, what we call Barry Island. It's the early right. days of the Porthcawl and all that stuff. It's the forerunner. It was the first sort of real big jazz summer school, which was in Barry. A big guy before I went to Pat Evans, a guy called Pat Evans ran it.
Right.
And anyway, I met my first wife there. And she came to London and we ended up living in two rooms in the World's End in Chelsea,
yeah.
which belonged to the flat actually was rented by a trombone player called Dave Perrottet, who'd worked for the BBC as a floor manager. He's quite a good valve trombone player. He seems an amateur yeah. player. You know, I met him in big bands. But he had this flat as a fictitious address because he wasn't living with his wife. It was long. The rest let us stay in the history. Yeah. And anyway, so this flat was out and he let us have it because you couldn't find places to live either.
Yeah.
It's not like that. You just could not find, but, you know, people were desperate to, you know, it's gone. It's gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Terrible places we used to see, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, even places where there would be the old bowl of water to wash it in your room, you know, really appallingly bad, and massive amounts of, you had to find fortunes of money to pay up front. I mean, there's no controls, it's just not, it was cowboy land. I mean,
yeah.
It started to change, but very hard to find anywhere to live.
Yeah.
And we had this little place, because I had a ball, I'm in Chelsea, you know, I loved it. Quite a few Australian musicians lived around there, all the ones that came to England that aren't here now, Jack Thorncraft, bass player, really good bass player, Neville Whitehead, used to do all the bass repairs for all the bass players. All the bass players knew Neville, good player.
Yeah.
A lot of horn players. So they all used to come in troops. And then, you know, they'd stay here for a year, a couple of years, and their visas would run out, they'd have to leave.
Yeah.
You know, at least go out the country and then come back. But they'd all come in front. So there was a load of Australian musicians here, great people, lots of fun, you know, and hang out with them around, around Chelsea.
Yeah. A
lot of music going on. Yeah.
Wow. So before we go, have you got any particular pearls of wisdom for anyone that's studying now, you know, about using their time or anything, you know?
Pearls of wisdom.
What would you say to yourself if you were 20 right now?
I think there's a various thing. I mean, obviously, people are different now, but I mean, certainly that thing about going out there and I certainly made mistakes about really taking charge of it, going out and getting it, putting yourself to always be available, go out and play, you know, meet as many people as you can, keep an open mind, I think is one thing. I certainly wasn't when I was young. I always had the same kind of biases. I don't like that. I didn't like Ornette Coleman, you know. And then years later, I think, hold on a minute, it's fantastic. You know, it's just, it's different. But keeping an open mind, putting yourself out. I mean, being out, being available, you know, all those lovely stories. Like, you never know who you're going to meet, even on a lousy commercial gig or something. You've always learned something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can learn how to read, you can practice, but you never know who you might end up sitting next to. You know what I mean? You suddenly meet next to somebody who also happens to be a bit like I saw Ken Wheeler on that session. If I'd have known how to speak to him, but I didn't, I wasn't equipped, but you know, you might be someone that's really important, just being out all the time. And I think for most people, try and get back some of the fact that it's a slow process, being a player. You can play for the rest of your life. You don't have to be, there's a big, heavy pressure on now for people to come out of college and you've got to be a star. Who's the latest star? You know, who's the big name? And it can be all over and gone in 5 minutes. And sometimes you miss the early part of your life. It's great to be playing for the rest of your life, you know.
Yeah.
So you've got and the joy of being there, and the fact that there'll always be what I found is the more you think, you don't learn more. You, as the older you get, the more you realise just how little you know. It gets more, it gets worse. You know, it's like, Christ, I don't know anything about anything really. But actually, it's great because there's always something to go and learn about. There's so much stuff to get, and I think that's one. You know what I mean? It's a wonderful thing. You can go out and go and learn about it, find out about it, see if you can involve it. And
Stan, time for a quick fire round. Who is your favourite player?
Oh no! Actually, I'm honestly not sure I could answer that because I've never been one to have. You know, I mean, I remember years and years ago, you know, John Coltrane, whatever, this one, that one, that. I'm not even sure it'd be a saxophone player.
Yeah.
I mean, I can pick some people that I think are really, I've always loved listening to, but I mean, I'd have to pick a couple, but there's a bit of a line. I mean, it would be Joe Henderson, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then follow, and obviously Rollins and.
Yeah.
And Coltrane, Getz, those kind of people.
Yeah.
The trouble is the list would just go on and on and on.
You just start naming everyone.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to pick. For some people, it might be an easy question. For some others, it might not be.
Yeah.
Because it's not that it changes. It's just that, you know, you keep adding things. Oh,
I was going to say that. I bet it gets harder.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose if I... Another way to look at it would be, funny enough, because if I was to look at it like who would be a very important person or influence, would might well be like John Taylor.
Yeah.
It has to be John or Ken, but yeah. I think probably John more so, because he was the time when I had my own first proper quartet with John, and he was just everything about that, the way he played, the way he wrote, everything was like, oh wow, you know, I really looked up to him.
Yeah,
it's a very, very powerful figure for me. So, yeah. If I had to pick a name, then maybe I might say that actually.
So, Do you have a favourite album?
Desert Island.
Desert Island Disc. Yes. Same problem. Same problem, isn't it?
We have storage problems. You can only pick one album.
No. If I was on a desert island, I'd probably pick something really stupid because I know it's going to be lonely there. I'd probably pick something silly like a Cannonball Adderley record, It's
something uplifting.
Because it makes the sun come out. You know, I always figured, even dark like Cannonball's Bossa Nova or the Cannonball at the Lighthouse.
Yeah.
Simply because it's just that kind of music. If you ever feel dark, put a Cannonball record on and you don't feel dark anymore. You know, I mean, it's dangerous territory picking your favourite song.
It certainly is.
Favourite album you've played on?
Oh, what's another? Oh, wow. Does it have to be my records or just anybody's records?
Anyone's
records.
Put you on the spot here.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Well, I played on... I mean, I've enjoyed all the ones I've done on my own, but... I certainly love playing the album I did with Mark Copeland and Bill Stewart, Narry Grenadier, because I love playing with those guys, but then I wouldn't get to, you know, and it was a one-off, I can't do it any other... to do it. Well, I mean, I enjoyed everything I've done. Other people's records. What would I put on? I mean, there's one I love and I don't play very much on it. I'm just in the band. I don't do anything. Is that Clark After Dark record, because I love Clark Terry. You know, it's as simple as that. It's got nothing to do with being modern or... It was just a lovely memory. I remember those 2 days. I remember the second day in the Olympic in Barnes, just across the, you know, mile down the road. When it finished, we all stood up for a band picture, and all of us, everybody was up, like, chests were out. And I remember crying, you know, and tears running down my face. It felt so emotional, because the writing was beautiful.
Yeah.
Fantastic writing, which was all European guys.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Hilbertson and Jerry Van Rooyen.
Mm-hmm.
And wonderful play. And it was just a lovely... Something about it was just a lovely 2 days, you know, so you remember those.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously, you know, there's large and small ensembles, Ken Wheeler is another, because it's a...
Yeah, that's a real iconic record, one, isn't it?
You know. But also the one, of course, for me, that was really special was Flutter by Butterfly, because it was just a quintet.
You had a killer flute solo on that album.
I love that record. Yeah. Because I love the tunes on it.
Yeah, that's
great. Dave and John Taylor, which I love. Dave Holland was fantastic.
Yeah.
It was a certain period in my life. I was just... split up with my first wife just afterwards, and I wasn't a very happy person.
Yeah.
A bit wild, and in fact, we all were for various
free
reasons.
Stuff on there as well.
But it's the whole thing was a sort of a potty month. It was part of a month on the road, which was absolutely fantastic. So that would probably be, I thought, wouldn't mind that.
Very nice, very nice.
I love that record.
So, what are you listening to at the moment?
What am I listening to? It's very, very dull and very predictable, really, but like a lot of people, I went back to. A lot of Warren Marsh albums, like everybody else has done, but because I'm very interested in that, sort of trying to do something about improving my line playing, you know, and a pure linear, trying to create better improvisation.
Yeah.
I mean, they often work from simple tunes.
Yeah.
But all the interest is in the creation rather than create a really complicated piece of music and then you kind of work, play it once or twice, do the record, but it's... The interest is kind of more in the composition rather, but where they'll take a really ordinary, well, I shouldn't say ordinary because the standards are lovely, but you know, one that's well trodden path.
Yeah.
But they'll suddenly, they come up with beautiful solos, you know. So there's that. I'm into funny things. I'll tell you what I played a lot recently, it was Jerry Mulligan Concert Band.
Wow.
I really like that band.
It's a
nice sound, you know. But I listen to a lot of music that isn't necessarily jazz music, you know. Yeah. for a while. I was starting to listen to either was a couple of either record I bought of James McMillan, a Scottish writer,
right,
which was a mass choir and organ, which was lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Piece. I really like some Messiaen pieces. Which I always go back to.
Yeah,
I think they're fantastic. Oh, anything really good, you know?
Yeah,
Bach.
I've always admired your ability to sort of sit on YouTube for hours and trawl through videos.
Oh, I'm terrible when I get started, yeah. But, you know, there's so much great music in there. I mean, all sorts of things I listen to. I like Larry Golding's trio.
Yeah.
Because I love Bill Stewart, you know. Yeah. I love that way of playing. So I enjoy it because they all play great, but I love that way of playing drums. It's all personal, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And there could be anything, you know. I mean, all sorts of... Somebody will turn up with something that's completely... off the wall, you know, totally different. And, oh, great, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that's something I just like to be surprised, you know. It's great having a son that plays, you know, because he's... What are you watching there, Matthew? You know.
Yeah. We're going to have to come back to that. I'd love to grill you on how you bullied him into becoming a saxophone player. Fantastic. So, Stan, if we want to check out more about you, where can we do it?
I've got a website which is stansulzman.co.uk, stansulzman, and there's sort of various bits of usual information, biogs, pics, and there is a track on there you can get a free download.
Oh, great.
The album I just did with Nicky Isles, which I really like, which is just us playing tunes. So it's kind of coming back in a full circle, really. Yeah. But I really like that project. You know.
Yeah.
So it's a good place as any to find stuff about me.
Great, that's the one. And then I'm sure from there you can find any listings of any gigs if you want to come.
Yeah.
See Stan play, that can definitely be arranged because he is out there playing probably more than everyone else I know. So yes, Stan, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
That's it from us. I hope you enjoyed listening to our episode with Stan. Next week, we're off to talk to Loz Garrett, which will be amazing. He's a supremely talented, supremely open, absolutely lovely bassist, and man, has he done some cool things. The Jazz Podcast can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and we can be found at thejazzpodcast.com, which will take you to our website, which has all our episodes listed. We're on Facebook. We have a Facebook group. We're also on Twitter, at the Jazz Podcast. So if you want to stay in touch, Dan and I are always up for a chat. That would be awesome. Any guests you'd like to see, questions you have, whatever it is, let us know. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. Tell your friends, your family, your brothers, sisters, daughter, husband, enemies, whatever you fancy. We'll be here every Friday. From Dan, from Stan, and myself, Rob Cope, we'll see you on Friday.